My name is Joseph Huff. My registration number is 34384. I represent Mr. Tapia, and I work for the Public Defender's Office. Because of the limited time we have here, I'm only going to briefly touch on the first issue I raised, but I'm going to first get into the second issue, which is failure to give the no-duty to retreat instruction. So I'll remind the court, it's fully preserved, nobody objects to that, and in the prosecution's brief, the attorney general's brief, there's no dispute that the defendant was somehow the initial aggressor as opposed to the victim. It's quite clear under these circumstances that while my client got into the argument with the clerk, with the victim, there was no initial physical aggression towards the victim. The victim is the one that grabbed my client, pushed his head into a glass door, took him out to the parking lot, picked him up, body slammed him onto the own hood of his car, and then repeatedly punched him out there. My client, in response, after he hit the ground, got up, retrieved a very small knife, and gave him a small cut in the abdomen, which didn't even count as serious bodily injury. As this court will remember, the victim didn't even want to press charges and didn't even show up to trial to testify against the defendant. Under these circumstances, I think it's beyond dispute that the court reversibly erred in failing to give the no duty to retreat instruction. And I think the only two cases you have to look to are Castles and Toler out of our Supreme Court. And I want to read to you the applicable quotes in those cases. In Castles, 2004, Colorado Supreme Court, a defendant is entitled to a jury instruction on the doctrine of no retreat when the facts of the case raise the issue of retreat and the evidence supports a jury finding that the defendant was not the initial aggressor. Failure, yes ma'am.
May I ask, and I apologize for interrupting, sure. But that's where I'm struggling a little bit.
So yes, ma'am.
Can you clarify for me why you believe the facts of the case or any argument, point to any argument in the record that raises the issue of duty to retreat in this case?
Well, first of all, the defense believed that there was a factual basis, and we represented to the court that that's why we're moving for this instruction. We believe that a reasonable jury could find that under these particular circumstances, Mr. Tapia should or could have just fled the scene and not stood his ground.
And so can you relate that either to the incident in the store or outside? What would that reasonable juror be doing that would say, I believe at this point in time there was a duty to retreat?
Once the victim, and I use that in quotes, slammed my client on top of his own car and my client rolled off and hit the ground, a reasonable juror could have said, that should have been the end of it for you, buddy. You overstayed your welcome in the store. You obviously weren't supposed to be there. They kicked you out. And now he's body slammed you on the hood of your car. Just get in your car and leave. Just turn the other cheek, walk away. And I think that's a reasonable sentiment to have as a juror. And not only did the prosecutor argue that in closing, but at sentencing, even the judge said, I think you both were stupid. I think you both were, just acting unreasonably. However, you're more at fault here because not only did you stab the victim, but you could have just walked away. Let me read you that exact quote. First of all, the prosecutor's closing. Tapia should have, quote, tried to go around Douglas. He should have, quote, leave.
That's when he was still in the store.
Well, the jury could have found that he should have not, he shouldn't have stood his ground there either.
Well, he didn't stab him in the store.
Well, that's a fair point, but the prosecutor goes on. Defendant was trespassing at the time. His use of force was not justified. He lost his self-defense when he was on the ground, which is what I'm talking about, when he fell off the hood of the car, and he chose to get up and got a couple of feet necessary to go back to the clerk and stab him.
But didn't that have to do with the fact that at that point there was testimony by other witnesses observing what happened outside, that the clerk had backed away at that point and the defendant was on the ground, the defendant got up and approached the clerk, and that's when the stabbing, there was no, according to witnesses, aggressive action by the clerk after the hood incident, when the defendant then was on the ground because the clerk had backed away. That was what it was referenced.
I read this transcript was that this happened very quickly and in close proximity. It's not like the clerk went back into the store, my client followed him back and stabbed him there. This all happened within the realm of a few feet and in the realm of a few seconds. That's what I gleaned from the transcript. But the point is, there was sufficient enough evidence in the record to show that a reasonable juror expected my client, Mr. Tapia, to get in this car and drive away, or just walk away. And the court at sentencing even said as much. He said, you also had the ability to turn and walk away. You had the ability to simply leave. Now, if the judge feels that way, contrary to the law, of course a reasonable juror is going to feel that way.
But wasn't that a reference to the fact that he was in the store, the clerk wasn't going to sell him the cigarettes, he told him several times to leave? Wasn't that, in fact,
I don't know if it was or not. This was one continuing altercation. It started in the store, and there was no real break in between. As soon as the victim grabbed my guy, and he's twice as big as my guy, shoves his head hard, pretty hard, as the witnesses said, into a glass door, takes him out, picks him up, body slams him on the hood of his car, and then continues, there is testimony that they continued the altercation even after he fell. That's sufficient. There's not enough breaks in between there to clearly break it down. Well, you could have turned and walked away here, but it's not necessary, but here you could have turned and walked away. It's all one continuous incident where a reasonable juror could have found that my client needed at any point during that altercation to just turn around and go away, get in his car, and leave. But that's not what the law is. If he's not the initial aggressor, and there's no argument that he was the initial aggressor, he has the right to stand his ground.
Can I just get clarification? I apologize again.
No problem.
So how do you compare retreat to being asked to leave and leaving, or being outside and being on the losing end, and a wise move might be stop the fight and leave? How does retreat differ from those two?
You're going to have to clarify
okay.
that.
So what I'm saying is, in the store, he was asked to leave.
Yes.
So leaving, how would that constitute retreating?
Well, leaving at that point would have meant he just needed to walk out the door. And the prosecutor said, go around Mr. Douglas. Mr. Douglas, as you might recall from the video and the testimony, was actually standing in front of the door and may have been preventing Tapia from actually leaving the altercation. But a juror could have found it's reasonable if you're in an altercation like that and you're told to leave at that point. It would have also been reasonable after you've been body slammed on the hood of your car by a man that's twice as big as you to turn away and leave.
Right, and to me that's not retreat, that's more recognizing the circumstances in which you're engaged and then this fight don't weigh
well,
in your favor.
I think it's a jury question. And I think that Toler and Castles leave it up to the jury, and they say when there is a reasonable possibility that the jury could have found that your client should have retreated, that it's reversible error not to give this instruction. There's no two ways about it. And Mr. Lee hasn't cited any case in his favor that would say under these particular facts, where that is a reasonable probability or possibility retreat, that you don't get it. He cited nothing. In fact, he says that these are only necessary in deadly force cases, but he cites no case that holds that. Castles and Toler certainly make no mention of that. And he agrees that the defendant wasn't the initial aggressor. So really, this is probably the easiest question I've ever had in front of this court. It's really quite that simple. Castles and Toler say you get it when the defendant is not the initial aggressor.
So are you saying that in any case where a defendant is not the initial aggressor, there should be
no
duty to retreat?
Because there are facts where the issue of retreat is not an issue. But it was in this case. Because the court said it was in this case at sentencing, because the DA said it was in closing argument, because we said it was when we asked to get the instruction, and the facts support that it was an issue in this case. If there are facts where retreat is not an issue, say it's your own home, for instance, there's no place to retreat to, it's not an issue. But when you have your car right there and you've been body slammed on it, a reasonable jury would tend to think, just leave at that point. There's nothing to be gained here. Just get in your car and drive away or walk away. And that's precisely what the prosecution said in closing, and that's what the court said at sentencing. If there are no other questions at this time, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Well, why don't you address the Toler point that the people make? That this was an unlawful trespass. He doesn't have a right to self-defense, period.
That's absolutely been rejected by Toler. I don't know if the prosecutor misread Toler, or if I did, or what. But the way I read Toler, and I'll quote it right here, the erroneous instruction told the jury the defendant was not entitled to claim self-defense because he was a trespasser. If the jury relied on the implication in the erroneous instruction, then they may have determined that the defendant, because he was not where he had the right to be, that he was a trespasser, should have retreated to the wall before using force to defend himself. That, to me, is very clear that they say if you're not the initial aggressor, it doesn't matter if you've trespassed. If you're not the initial aggressor, you still have the right to have this instruction when there's a reasonable jury question that you could have retreated.
And the case also says a trespasser who is subjected to lawful physical force by the owner or occupant of property has no privilege to use physical force in self-defense, because the privilege applies only when the defendant faces unlawful force.
Correct.
That's the point.
That's a jury question, though. That's an absolute jury question, was whether he was being confronted out in that parking lot with unlawful physical force. I'm not saying he was a trespasser in there. I'm not saying that once the victim body slammed him on the car, he was a trespasser. The point is, that's a jury question, and...
Well, on your first issue, you say giving this instruction along these lines was error.
Well, I say it's error.
It's a jury question. They had to be instructed on it then, didn't they?
It's a jury question if the prosecutor meets all the elements for the instruction, and because they did not call the victim in this case, the instruction shouldn't have been given. Because there are four elements to that instruction, or that defense of premises statute. The person has to be in possession of the building. He has to be justified in using reasonable and appropriate force to the extent necessary to prevent or terminate an unlawful, what he reasonably believes to be an unlawful trespass. So number one, person in possession of a building. I'm not saying that Douglas was in possession of the building, particularly when he was outside of the building. He was acting probably beyond his capacity as a 7-Eleven clerk. He was fired for his handling of this situation. He left his post. He assaulted a customer out in the parking lot. I think under those facts, he doesn't even meet the first element, which is the person must be in the possession of a building. But even considering that he was, even arguing that he was, because he was not testified, because he was not required to testify or called to testify, we had nothing on the final element, which is what he reasonably believes to be an unlawful trespass. We never heard from Douglas. We never had Douglas say he reasonably believed that this was unlawful trespass. There was no testimony by him. Again, he blocked the door at one point. He went outside with the defendant. My client was never charged as a trespasser. The jury was never instructed on the elements of trespass. So I'm saying, as an initial matter, they shouldn't have gotten that instruction because they simply didn't have enough evidence in the record without calling the victim to get that instruction. Now, had they, might be a different issue whether it is a jury question or not. Had that instruction been appropriate under the facts, which I'm saying it wasn't, it still would be a jury question. But so is my client's right to have a no duty to retreat instruction. That's a jury question as well. The jury was not allowed to consider that here, and it accounts for a reversible error. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal, all 25 seconds of it. Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Mayne, behalf of the people, Arnold 38141. Excuse me. I'd like to start off where defense counsel left off, because I don't think his argument on the first issue adequately grapples either with the applicable law or the facts of this case. As this court pointed out, the instruction that was given here was expressly authorized under the logic of Toler, where our Supreme Court explained that a trespasser does not stand in the same shoes as an innocent person in employing defensive force. As the line that Judge Richmond read, the court said at 353, quote, a trespasser who was subjected to unlawful physical force by an owner or occupant of property or premises has no privilege to use self-defense under section 18.1704 because such privilege only applies to those who to defendants who face unlawful force. So to the extent that those statutes modify whether or not a trespasser does or does not face lawful force, then instructions probably given to the jury. And in this case, the issue was raised. There was testimony prevented from both eyewitnesses, Zenos and the other one, that the defendant was trespassing in the store. Although the clerk didn't testify, both witnesses testified that it was Zenos and Dutcher, that the defendant was asked to leave, but persisted and refused to leave, and in fact threatened the clerk. That's on page 60, I think, on February 28th, and page 11 on the February 29th transcript. So given that the facts raise the issue that the defendant was in fact trespassing or was asked to leave, given that the jury could find that the clerk's force was reasonable and that could modify the defendant's own reasonable belief in using physical force and what he believed to be or not to be lawful physical force, is properly given to the jury.
So the fact that he was a trespasser, though, he still had a right to use self-defense if the jury found that the clerk's use of force was unlawful, either because he didn't have a basis to believe that he was a trespasser or the degree of force that he used may have been unreasonable?
Yes, Your Honor. And
under so you agree with that?
Yes. And under the court's instructions, the jury was permitted to make that inference, should they have wanted to. And I don't think there's any dispute that the court's instructions on self-defense and affirmative self-defense there are no problems in those instructions in this case.
I think counsel for the defendant suggested that there has to be evidence, I'll just put in the terms of this case, that the clerk reasonably believed that his use of force was lawful. And in absence of the clerk testifying, there's no way the jury could have determined whether the clerk believed his use of force was reasonable. How do you respond to that?
That's absolutely not a requirement. And I would point this court to the flip side of when a defendant claims self-defense, which they claim often and often you get the instruction when they don't testify. You don't need to have direct evidence from the person using the force to raise that issue. Instead, there just needs to be facts and evidence for which the jury can infer. And here, I don't think there can be no reasonable dispute that the jury can. There's certainly evidence for the jury to infer that the clerk used and thought he needed to use the force in order to stop the trespass in this case. So, turning to the second issue, although Colorado law does not require a duty to retreat, it also doesn't authorize payback. So, looking at the facts of this case, it explains why the trial court correctly exercised its discretion in refusing the defendant's no duty to retreat instruction. Even under defense counsel's argument today that this was just one fight, that there was no break, I think were the words that he used, that there was no chance for defendants, there was no break in between the fights. The issue of retreat was never an issue done before the jury. To the extent he's correct that it was just one fight and the defendant never could have retreated, then that's exactly what we had in Hoffman, where the division of this court found that you only get a duty to retreat instruction if the facts raise it. And in this case, the facts just don't raise it. Because even under the defendant's theory, the jury never would have thought that because if they believed what the defendant believed, he never had a chance to retreat.
Why couldn't he get up after being thrown on the car and drive away, like counsel suggests?
Well, I think that goes to the other. So looking at the facts case, so under their view, which is a relevant consideration, under Castles, the issue of retreat never came up. Under, I think, the evidence actually presented and what the people argued, the issue of retreat never came up just because the argument was not that the defendant should have run away, it's that he wasn't threatened with any imminent unlawful physical force when he stabbed the victim. The uncontroverted account at trial established that after he fell off the car, the clerk threw his hands up in the air and said, "No knives, man." He took a few steps back, the defendant then took a couple steps forward and then stabbed him with a knife. Given that uncontroverted account, the issue really was whether the defendant was acting in self-defense at all, not whether or not he should have retreated and didn't use reasonable force. So when we compare this case to the other cases, the only cases where a Colorado appellate court has actually found that it was reversible error not to put in a duty to retreat instruction, the facts we have here are not at all tantamount to those cases. The defendant cited Toler, I believe, but that case dealt more with the initial aggressive problem. Three cases that did find it that I think he cites in his brief are Castles, Idrago, and Garcia. In Castles, the facts were the defendant, rather than he went into the bedroom, got his gun, and rather than staying in the bedroom, came out of the bedroom and then shot the victim. So in that issue, retreat was an issue. In Garcia, the victim ran away, and then rather than going for the door, went, picked up an axe, came back, and then chopped the victim. Retreat was an issue in that case. In Hidrago, the victim was running away, the defendant was running away, and rather than stopping, or rather than continuing, stopped and then stabbed the victim. So in those cases, the facts actually raised the issue of retreat. Not only factually, but we could explain in our answer brief also legally. Because the legal distinction between this case and that case is all of those cases involve the use of deadly physical force, which this court is aware when a jury is instructed on the use of deadly physical force, they not only get the standard self-defense instruction that we have in this case, but they get the additional element that the defendant is not allowed to use deadly physical force if less degree of force was, only if less degree of force was inadequate. So when you're given that instruction, it plainly puts the amount of force the defendant uses at issue, and then retreat, and the possibility of retreat, then also becomes an issue. We didn't have that in this case, so factually and legally, I think the argument is without foundation.
So can I clarify, are you saying that the issue of retreat is only applicable in the cases where deadly force is used?
Those are the only cases, public cases I know, where the court has ever found it to be, and I think it makes sense when you think about the instructions that they're given. Because generally what we'll have in a non-deadly physical force case is kind of what we have in this case. But the issue isn't really whether or not the defendant used reasonable force, it's whether or not they're acting in self-defense to begin with. Because it's only when the issue is put before the jury that the defendant could not avail himself to the amount of force used, if there was an alternative, does it actually become an issue before the jury. Just to give an example, I mean, normally what we're going through a juror's head in the non-deadly physical force case is it's just what both sides argue, which is whether or not the defendant felt he or she needed to use the force, whether or not the degree of force was reasonable. Normally that doesn't ask the question of what alternatives could have been done for the amount of force. Like I said, in this case, it's even one further step removed, because in this case, it really is just an issue of whether or not the defendant had a right to self-defense at all. Because the conflict was done, and then he just went and stabbed the clerk after the clerk had withdrawn.
Let us say, in summary, you don't take issue with the defendant's position that he was not the initial aggressor, do you?
I think that was a jury question. I mean, I don't take issue that the jury could find that he was not the initial aggressor, but I think they could have found he was.
All right, so if he's not the initial aggressor, he might be entitled to a no duty to retreat instruction if the facts support it.
Only if the facts support it, yes.
And you're saying the facts here did not support it, because even though he could have gotten up after being thrown on the car and rolled to the ground and driven away, those do not amount to facts that suggest to the jury a duty to retreat.
Yes, and I think maybe it would have been, we had different facts than we have here. So, for example,
don't take the facts. Let's see what that.
Okay.
Why doesn't that suggest a duty to retreat? I guess I know it's a hard question to answer. Why doesn't that? So he suggested that suggested to the jury. The jury might have thought, at that point, he should have driven away. And that's maybe that amounts to retreat. I don't even know if that amounts to retreat. But why don't those facts satisfy that part of the test?
And it kind of goes back to the very first thing I said, there's a difference between retreat and payback. So given the facts of this case, when the encounter is done, once he falls off, it's not that the focus of the issue and the issue for the jury was not whether the defendant should have run away. It's whether or not the conflict was over, and whether therefore he could not claim self-defense in re-engaging and stabbing the clerk. So that's why no retreat. That's why the issue of retreat was not raised before the jury. And to clarify, I am going to try and chase facts a little bit if I can. It would be a different issue, I think, if had the clerk then chased the defendant. So let's say he throws him off, and then we had evidence that the clerk then moved towards the defendant and was going to hit him again. In that case, so if the car was, if the clerk's on one side of the car and the defendant is on the driver's side of the car and the defendant said he has his keys, you know, then I think arguably it would be a closer case. But still, because I don't think the no duty to retreat is normally not an issue in non-deadly physical force, in cases not involving deadly physical force, it would still just be an issue whether or not the defendant was acting in self-defense.
Okay.
So if the court has no further questions, then she affirmed. Thank you.
I've got one rhetorical question for this court. If the issue of retreat was not reasonably raised by the facts, why did number one, we bring it up and ask for an instruction on it with an offer of proof? Number two, why did the prosecutor argue that he should have retreated after he hit the ground in closing? And number three, why did the court at sentencing repeatedly say you should have just walked away? Of course it was an issue.
Those are three questions.
Good point.
Your time's up. Thank you.
Thanks.